So what you're entitled to get is, should be expanded. We believe that jury trial and the right to a jury trial should be absolute. When you're talking about taking away a person's ability to care, think, and do for themselves. We also believe that the inception, when a person is actually going to the very first hearing to determine whether or not they are incompetent, that the person should be entitled to a jury trial. We believe there should be a change of the law that would allow for reasonable times to which to sell property under the probate code. In Mr. Epstein's mother's case, an order was entered to sell the large income-producing piece of property 8 years before it was sold. At the time of the sale, none of the facts which existed 8 years previous, sorry, I don't generally don't have that problem. None of the facts which existed 8 years previous were even relevant at that point in time. They no longer existed. Yet the court followed the law and sold the property, no best interest test being appropriate or being contained within the code. Perhaps one of the more interesting aspects of what we propose is that if a fiduciary steals, he or she should be charged with a crime. Perhaps nothing is more important that if you're charged with caring for a person, and if you decide to steal from them, you should be charged with a crime. We do believe that the charging of excessive fees should be determined to be theft. I believe under 32.45 of the Texas Penal Code, which already deals with claims and cause of action of criminal nature against fiduciaries.
Wait a minute, are you saying attorney fees that a judge approves it can then be held to be a criminal offense? Who are you going to charge? You going to charge the attorney or the judge? Is judge going to be a co-conspirator?
Sir, many times people in fiduciary capacities steal from their wards. We are not suggesting that if a court has approved a fee that anybody be charged with theft.
Well, if they're stealing from the estate, that would be a crime. That the way I heard you phrase that, it would be an award of attorney fees.
If attorney's fees had been charged in excess of the statute amount, would you not consider that theft?
So what, are you tied up on the $50 still?
No, sir. I'm tied up on people being paid a fair fee and wards who really can't speak for themselves. If I send you a bill for Senator
Harris, if the attorney shows that he has spent the time that is enumerated in the bill, shows that it was reasonable and necessary to protect the assets of the ward or to represent the ward, and the judge has approved them, are you saying in those cases someone can still be charged with felony theft?
No, sir. I think estoppel and res judicata would apply. Senator Harris, if I send you a bill for work I do for you, and you say, David, that's too much money, that's too high, you have the ability to do that. But if I'm your guardian and you're incapacitated, you never see the bill I send you. I write the bill, I approve it, I pay it myself after the court approves it. We're not suggesting if the court approves it, it should be a crime. It's just if lawyers are out there charging excessive fees. The civil case, I understand, is called surcharge in probate court. We believe it should be added teeth of the criminal nature. But this is pre-approval of the court. I think the laws of Texas would prevent any type of action after it's been approved.
Thank you.
Senator Gallegos has a question.
We have one.
No, go ahead and finish.
Finally, to touch on an issue which you've heard here today already, that is of recusal. I forget which one of you asked the question, but as I understand it, in county courts and in district courts if a recusal is filed upon a judge. The administrative judge of that particular region assigns a judge to hear the recusal. We simply believe that that would have a better appearance of fairness if probate judges also came within those same guidelines. There are only 17 statutory probate judges in this state. Why not spread that out a little bit and let the administrative judge of each region assign a judge to hear these cases? Those are our guidelines. We're not trying to take up too much time. We'd be happy to answer any questions you choose to email us or send us. Yes, sir.
Appreciate you being here. Senator Gallegos has a question.
One final question, Mr. Wilkerson. You testified earlier that the lawyers try to at least visit their wards on a regular basis. And
I think his testimony was that they don't visit their wards
on
a regular basis.
Was it they don't visit?
They don't.
They don't. Okay.
But
all right.
The voluntary wards do at least once a month.
Okay. And I guess I'm telling my years here. When I was still at the fire station, I'd heard some of the young law students that were past the bar that they were living on ad litem cases alone. That's all they took. Tell me that's not.
To a court appointments on ad litem.
Well, what?
Court appointments.
Court appointments.
There could be court appointments in.
Is that still happening?
I don't know, sir. Maybe ad litems might be a good training ground for young lawyers, but
I don't even know what the word means, but you know.
Ad litems are used throughout the judicial system.
I'm talking about the statement I just made that I heard we're talking about back in the 60s and 70s, that those attorneys strictly work on court-appointed cases.
Sometimes that might be a good system, sir. In other words, if you took a young lawyer who can actually represent the interests of a child and watch more seasoned lawyers do that, that's a good training ground. And that's not just probate cases, that's civil cases, oftentimes in personal injury, ad litems were appointed to represent children.
So in your opinion, that's still happening?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Epstein, do you have anything you wanted to add?
Since we're running out of time, I'll go ahead and pass.
We'd be glad to hear from you if you'd like to say something.
Okay, I'd like to maybe finish a little bit.
You bet.
If you don't mind.
Please hear from you.
Again, I'd like to thank you for your attention on this issue. You may ask yourself why I spent so much time and money getting here. It's not because I need the money, nor do I need my mother's money. It's simply that the court-appointed guardians, probate, and appeals courts have failed my mother and many others also. It is just wrong and must be corrected. Those who defend the current guardianship case rely on one case that was cited in my mother's appeal. It's the Henderson case. And I'd like to quote from that and read it, if you don't mind, the short part of it. It's on tab 7, page 46. It's the last paragraph, lower right-hand column. And please indulge me on reading. The court reasons that public policy favors dual compensation because one functioning in both capacities should avoid duplication of work and could thus lower cost. The probate court is a true protector of the estate's interest as conducts a final review of all monies leaving the estate. Probate courts will most closely scrutinize the application of attorney's fees submitted by the representative serving in dual capacity, resulting in an even greater protection of the estate. And the relationship between the attorney and client and guardian and ward is based on trust, so that we should presume that an individual serving in both capacities would perform her duty in a manner that is in the best interest of the estate. The plain and simple fact is that this is a fairy tale. It's not happening. The guardians aren't protecting the wards. The probate courts aren't protecting the wards. The appellate courts aren't protecting the wards. The only one it's going to be up to the legislators to protect the wards. The plain and simple fact is the legislators are going to have to stop the abuse that the and to tighten up the to tighten up the probate laws. They are too loose currently. They allow for too much wiggle room, and you have guardians which blur the line between guardians and attorneys when they hire themselves, and then they charge their regular attorney's fees, and they're fleecing the wards, and there is nobody currently that is hearing their voice or protecting them. That's all I have to say.
Mr. Epstein, we appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here this morning. Chair calls Robert Alpert. Morning. Welcome.
May I have my son sit up here as well? These trusts relate to him.
You bet. He needs to fill out a card as well.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Robert Alpert. I have long taught my sons that you can be part of a solution or you can be part of a problem. I am hoping that we and this committee will be part of a solution. I've been involved in a situation involving three trusts I formed for my children for now 7.5 years. This case was tried, ended in June of 2005, and a year later, we finally got a judgment. I'd like to tell you some of the facts, not because I'm merely trying to take your time and tell you a story, but because the facts of this case, the abuses within this case, bring rise to the recommendations that I will provide as related to modifications in legislation. Imagine what it is like to work for over 30 years and create trust for your children to pay for their education and contribute to their financial security. Imagine the orchestration of a scheme by your former lawyer to make himself trustee of the trusts, to steal money from those trusts and execute a plan to enrich himself at the expense of your children. The beneficiaries, your children, are not consulted, formally oppose the litigation initiated by the trustee, and relieve the alleged trustee of any conceivable duty to prosecute his claims. Yet the trustee ignores your children while he executes his scheme. Who under the law can one rely on to stop such an injustice? Since it involves trusts, if a lawsuit is filed in probate court, you would expect to be able to rely on a probate judge to enforce the law, to protect the interests of the beneficiaries. Imagine that the very judge you rely on turns out to have an agenda of his own to enrich his friends and former law firm by authorizing the distribution of several $1 million from these trusts to them. Imagine a judge who ignores the wishes and interests of the beneficiaries, ignores the facts when evidence of the scheme undertaken by your former lawyer, and ignores the findings of the jury, which after 6 years of litigation conclude the lawyer has breached his fiduciary duty. Imagine a judge then prolonging the agony and refusing to enter a judgment for yet another year. A judgment that, when finally signed, is inconsistent with the jury findings. And the judge discharges the alleged trustee and then releases the trustee for all the blatantly illegal actions he has taken. And then, in violation of both the trust instrument and the law, the judge reappoints the same person he's discharged, the very person the jury determined had breached his fiduciary duties. Judges should not be able to abuse their judicial power to enrich their friends. Judges should not violate the code of judicial conduct, all with impunity. All judges in Texas must recognize and honor their duty to serve and adjudicate matters in accordance with the laws of the great state of Texas. They must not be allowed to arbitrarily give away to strangers the financial resources that were to be preserved for loved ones. The discretion of abusive probate judges must be contained by legislation, and the rights of beneficiaries to challenge an abusive judge must be expanded and protected. I fully realize the committee does not have a mandate to punish judges. This is not my purpose in coming here today. My purpose and goal is to help the legislature understand certain abuses in the probate system and encourage legislation to stop the abuses. Today you will hear of a pattern of conduct in several cases presided over by Judge Michael Wood of Harris County Probate Court Number 2. You will hear how Judge Wood has exploited the assets of families for the benefit of his friends. My purpose for being here is to encourage the change, to avoid the possibility of such devastating conduct in the future. What I'm about to describe happened to my family and could happen to your family. It has no doubt happened to the families of some of your constituents. In fact, it happens to families with more frequencies than most people realize. Many of those families are powerless to even complain. They should not be faced with this problem. The law should have protected my family. It should protect all families, but it doesn't. I hope this committee will take the steps to change that. In 1994, I hired Mark R. Riley, a CPA and attorney, as in-house counsel and corporate counsel. This man became a trusted officer in my private investment company. During his period of employment, my father became very, very ill and ultimately died in the summer of 1997. I, like many of you, was very, very close to my father, and his loss was devastating to me. During this period of time, I relied on Riley to oversee my passive business investments. In addition, Riley worked to facilitate the instructions of independent trustees of three trusts that I had formed for my two sons. Since 1990, I made annual gifts to two of my sons' trusts. In cooperation with the trustees, I loaned large sums of money to the trusts within guidelines provided by my accountants so that each trust could make investments and accelerate its growth. As a result of the loans, the trusts accumulated net assets of $3.5 million prior to litigation commenced by Riley in the spring of 1999. During the summer of 1998, I became very concerned about Riley's personal and professional conduct. And in September of the same year, I determined that it was in my family's best interest to terminate his employment. In the spring of 1999, Riley filed a lawsuit against me asserting that he was trustee of my three children's trusts. I didn't appoint him. He claimed that I had breached a fiduciary duty to the trusts. Never mind that no lawyer to whom I have ever spoken thinks a grantor owes a continuing duty to trusts formed. Of course, my family and I were shocked that Riley had initiated this campaign against me. In subsequent months, I learned Riley's motivation when he attempted to shake me down, asking for a payment to him, not the trusts, of $300,000 to end the litigation. Of course, it would have been much more cost effective to simply pay him the money and let him go away. But I was not prepared to demonstrate to my sons that that kind of conduct was acceptable. So I elected to defend the lawsuits. Little did I know that Riley's plan was so elaborate that it would make Andrew Fastow blush. In the subsequent 4 years, I learned the following. Prior to working for my company, Riley had developed a plan to change his identity and move abroad if he could accomplish his goal of embezzling $10 million from his former employer. That was learned through Riley's own handwritten notes, which were discovered after he was no longer my employee. Riley was fired by that employer. Riley intercepted a $138,000 federal income tax refund which represented money I had advanced at Riley's direction to one of the trusts to pay taxes he advised were due when they were not. Riley then sought a refund of the funds paid and had them directed to him. The funds were never repaid to me. They did not even remain in the trust to which I advanced. Instead, 70% of the refund was used by Riley to serve his own interests. In a hearing in October 1999 before Judge Wood, Riley lied three times through his lawyer, Darlene Payne Smith, saying he had not received the check. He had, in fact, received it and cashed it. In another hearing in December, Riley and Payne Smith misled the court by failing to disclose that they had already removed 70% of the proceeds, including money paid to Payne Smith's law firm. They said the money was in an appropriate trust account. That's not true. Amazingly, Judge Wood ultimately even awarded Riley a judgment against me to reimburse Riley for the amounts he used from my funds to pay his lawyers to sue me. I received none of the money back, and the trust which borrowed the money from me ended up with a debt to me it couldn't repay because Riley and his lawyers, rather than the trust, ended up with the money, all with Judge Wood's blessing. Discovery confirmed the most significant of the transactions which Riley complained about in the lawsuit were transactions that he personally designed and executed in my absence. This fact was reconfirmed through subsequent testimony of third-party witnesses during the trial. Yet in the face of overwhelming evidence to the contrary, Judge Wood determined that Riley was the trustee, that he should have no responsibility for the actions he took while claiming to be trustee, and that he should remain as trustee despite my family's understandable desire, repeatedly expressed, to rid themselves of Riley and his interference in their financial affairs. The most shocking evidence is yet to come. We discovered in the same time frame that Riley filed his lawsuits against me. He entered negotiations with the Internal Revenue to become an anonymous, confidential, paid informant. This is the stuff of which they write books. He was to be paid as both a lawyer and receive a fee of up to $7.5 million if the allegations he put forth were true. Riley used his position of confidence as my personal lawyer and as the alleged trustee of my children's trust in an effort to gain a substantial financial reward for himself. The allegations put forth by Riley were not truthful. Obviously, this conduct was a breach of his fiduciary duty to the children's trust. It was also a breach of his attorney-client duties to me and my companies. The Internal Revenue Service Criminal Division investigated me and the trust for 4 years and closed the file in August 2004 without any action against me. The Internal Revenue Civil Division also investigated and ultimately accepted all of the tax returns as filed without change, which affirmed that his allegations were without merit. Although Riley denied under oath that he had backdated documents used to appoint himself as trustee of my three children's trusts, his legal assistant confirmed the backdating in a deposition. This single fact, when combined with the deceptions described above, would clearly convince any reasonable fact finder that Riley was unfit to serve as trustee. Nonetheless, Judge Wood did not allow the jury to hear and decide the contested issue concerning Riley's backdating and if he was properly appointed the trustee. But notwithstanding the judge withholding essential evidence from the jury determined that Riley had breached his fiduciary duties, and yet the judge reversed it. Following Riley's employment with my company, he became involved with another Houston entrepreneur. And sure enough, Riley then executed another scheme to extract money from that person. Being a probate judge of Harris County is a prestigious public position, but it comes with a weighty responsibility. The Code of Judicial Conduct in the state of Texas is comprised of 8 canons, a copy of which I will provide with my written presentation after the hearing. I believe Judge Wood ignored his duties and responsibilities as described in the Code of Judicial Conduct by pursuing an agenda to enrich his former law firm and appointee friends at the expense of my family. I believe it has happened to other families to whom it has been even more devastating. The law should be changed to protect from such abuses. The underlying premise of Riley's lawsuit was that a grantor of a trust has a fiduciary duty to that trust. Every lawyer with whom I've spoken on this subject has indicated that a grantor does not have a fiduciary duty to a trust. A responsible judge who is respecting the judicial canons would have dismissed Riley's case in the early days of litigation when all interested parties besides Riley formally opposed the litigation. Riley, however, retained the law firm most likely to succeed in Harris County Probate Court Number 2. It quickly became apparent that Judge Wood wanted to provide an opportunity for his former law firm, whose senior partner, Frank Harmon, has been one of his closest friends for decades. Mr. Harmon has been involved in the election of more than 20 judges in Texas and is considered the Harris County judicial kingmaker. Mr. Harmon's wife is Federal Judge Melinda Harmon, who previously has been recused when presiding over matters related to Mike Wood. The same law firm and the same lawyer, Darlene Payne Smith, this is the lawyer who lied to the judge in October and December 1999, as I described earlier, is even representing Judge Wood's bonding company in a separate case about a witness about which a witness will testify. To clarify, it's related to Ms. Norman's client, Mr. Watley. I believe Judge Wood violated the canons by exercising a blatant pattern of bias. An example was evidenced in a hearing on March 11, 2004, when my counsel stated he wanted to take the deposition of an important witness who had personal knowledge of Riley's scheme. Judge Wood said, "Do you," referring to grantor's counsel, "really want to take his deposition if it means they," referring to the plaintiff's lawyers, "get their fees paid in full, and I start paying the attorney fees for their new lawyer if they still want to withdraw? I think that's what's going to happen. I'm going to pay them all their back fees and pay their new lawyer fees out of the trust until this thing is tried in the next century sometime." During 6 long years, I watched in disappointment how Judge Wood started as a fact finder, became a biased jurist, and ultimately became an unvarnished advocate for the client of his former firm in his effort to enrich them. I believe Judge Wood violated the judicial canons by authorizing payments to friends and cronies of approximately $2 million for my children's trust. On January 7, 2005, Judge Wood awarded James Raymond, who claimed to be one of Judge Wood's closest personal friends, $120,000 after refusing my children's counsel an opportunity to adequately question Mr. Raymond's invoices as to their reasonableness and necessity. In total frustration, following the hearing, I approached the bench and I asked Judge Wood, in the presence of numerous witnesses, "Sir, don't you have any more friends you'd like to enrich at my children's expense?" And the judge said, "I think I can find a few." I believe Judge Wood ignored the laws of the state of Texas to achieve his personal objectives, but the law should have made that impossible.
He's going to give it to us.
The law should protect my family and any other families from such violations. The law should prevent a judge from achieving his personal objectives at the expense of the people who have come before him, many of whom are much more vulnerable. Texas law, as now written, however, has left my family with only one hope of undoing the harm caused, a long and costly appeal, which will be fought by Riley with my children's remaining trust assets. Because Riley was reappointed by Judge Wood as trustee. On the other hand, during that appeal, I am faced with the prospect of having to post a bond for millions of dollars to prevent Riley's seizure of assets, including the home in which my 81-year-old mother lives and the home in which my minor son and his mother live. Lest you think I'm overreacting, let me assure you that Riley has already initiated legal proceedings in the states where these homes are located. I don't know how much of my children's $3.5 million remains, if any, because Riley, in further breach of his duties, and his lawyers continue to refuse to tell the beneficiaries the location and balance of their assets in their trusts, and have offered no distributions to the beneficiaries as required by the governing trust instruments. I believe Judge Wood violated judicial canons by having ex parte communications with his appointees and his former law firm, which represented Riley. It was very evident in court when Judge Wood made various comments, the substance of which he could only have known through ex parte communications, since there was no testimony in court nor filings made with such information. The judicial canons impose the responsibility of a judge to perform his duties of judicial office impartially and diligently. It is the judge's responsibility to use his best efforts to properly apply the law and, as a result, have confidence in the correctness of his rulings. During the trial, Judge Wood said, "The odds of this case surviving an appeal are nil. So we're going to be back again. I'm just hoping and praying for reversal and render instead of a reversal and remand." Then later he said, "Right, I'm sure that I've made so many mistakes in this, you're going to have to ask for relief from the briefing limits." Judge Wood made these statements following his decision to improperly incorporate in the summary judgments he previously entered against me in the jury instruction. This blatant effort to taint the jury, combined with several dozen other errors by Judge Wood during the trial, virtually assured that the Alpert family would not achieve resolution and would likely have to retry the case all over again, long after Judge Wood's friends had completely depleted the $3.5 million set aside for my children's future financial security. While hearing a post-trial motion, Judge Wood stated the following to my children's counsel. My children's counsel said, "With regard to that, under Property Code Section 114.064, it states that it's not a prevailing party statute that attorney fees are be awarded. Attorney fees under that section is not dependent on the finding that the interveners substantially prevailed or that they prevailed at all." And that's out of also Hacker Senior versus Hacker 153 S period W period 3D 138 Texas Appellate Court, San Antonio. And the judge said, "Well, you understand that isn't law in this court because that's San Antonio. Last I heard, San Antonio was part of the great state of Texas." Such statements confirm Judge Wood was serving his will and personal objectives rather than applying the law in this case. It seems rather inappropriate that Judge Wood would suggest that a ruling from an appellate court in San Antonio would not be the law in his court. In January 2000, Judge Wood appointed Karen Gerstner as receiver and trustee of my children's trusts. This is the ruling that Judge Herman referred to earlier. Ms. Gerstner failed to manage the assets of the trust, lost $600,000 by ignoring the stock portfolio, invested cash in a money market fund earning only 1.5%, and charged the trust in excess of $300,000 for her purported services, including legal fees. Ms. Gerstner did not manage or benefit the trust other than hiring an accountant to file tax returns. Ms. Gerstner even failed to hire a third-party professional money manager. She merely parked the assets. In violation of the trust instrument, Ms. Gerstner never was in contact with the beneficiaries. Ms. Gerstner merely took the money provided by Judge Wood's patronage. My children sued Ms. Gerstner in district court. But due to what I believe were the behind-the-scenes manipulations by Judge Wood's wife, who was present, who is a Harris County district judge, the case was mysteriously transferred to Judge Mike Wood without either plaintiff or the defendant making such a request. In January 2005, Judge Wood granted his appointee judicial immunity in a clear effort to hide his failure to exercise oversight of his appointee. This summer, the First Court of Appeals completely reversed Judge Wood's ruling related to Ms. Gerstner's judicial immunity for fiduciary functions. I know it's hard to believe, but this story is much longer, and the abuses my family has suffered are even deeper than described. The bad news is that it is unclear when, if ever, my family will recover from its encounter with the trustee from hell. The good news is that this should be a wake-up call to the Texas legislature. And if the Texas legislature takes responsibility to Texas litigants seriously, this need not continue to happen to other families. The proposed legislation that I wanted to put forth may require a little bit of a off-the-cuff preamble. You've heard comments earlier that there are 17 statutory probate judges in the state of Texas. It's a small circle of friends. They get together at conferences. They very, very, very rarely recuse each other. We had two initiatives of recusal, one after Judge Wood said we try this case in the next century. Sure sounded biased to me. Judge McCullough said in that hearing that he didn't think he was serious, that he was just trying to move the case along. A short time later, Judge Wood paid out over $500,000 of my children's money to his former law firm. This is all without a judgment. This is all without a trial. That was shocking. We felt it was inappropriate for Judge McCullough to hear the recusal, since there are two of four judges in Harris County who are friends. So we asked Judge McCullough to recuse himself. He kept us waiting in the courtroom a number of hours and came back and then decided he could be fair, made the comments that I described, and then Judge Wood did what I described as well. The 14th Court of Appeals in the Whatley case recently came out and ruled, correctly so I believe, that if a judge is under recusal and another judge is going to hear that case and it is requested that he recuse himself, that he also is laboring under recusal and cannot hear the case. But the bigger problem is it's a small circle of friends. There needs to be a much broader base of judges to hear recusals in the probate court who's not in that small circle of friends that can simply judge the issues. And the issues generally are that of bias. And any of us can judge bias, and certainly any seasoned jurist could judge bias. But they're not given the opportunity because these probate judges are protecting each other. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. I can show this committee case after case after case where that's the case. My suggestions are as follows. There is at least the very public perception that the probate courts in Harris County are unfair and even corrupt, with Judge Mike Wood of Harris County Probate Court Number 2 being the poster boy of judicial misconduct. There are only four courts, and the manner in which these cases are assigned to those courts at this time allows an attorney to basically select the court to which the case is assigned. I'm told this happens on a regular basis so that a particular lawyer who is viewed with particular favor by a court ensures that the cases land in that judge's court. What that means is that, right or wrong, that attorney and his client win. This is the definition of a broken system. The committee should authorize hearings to review the allegations concerning abuses so that it is in position to make appropriate recommendations to the Texas Supreme Court concerning how to best address the loss of confidence in the Harris County probate courts. One of the major problems is that recusal process is completely ineffective. I understand that the recusal rules 18A and 18B have been the subject of a Supreme Court advisory committee since at least January of 1997. That is right, January 1997. And all the while, the recusal system is completely unable to address the very problem it is designed to solve. This committee should conduct hearings in which testimony from experts on the issue of the current recusal process is taken so that the problems associated with the recusal process in general are addressed. But in order to fully appreciate and address the abuses which the recusal system should be addressing, but which it is not, testimony should also be received from litigants who have turned to the courts for help, not only to find the courts more protective of the judges than the litigants. Only by hearing about the problems from those who have experienced it firsthand can the committee really make appropriate and meaningful recommendations to address what is needed to restore confidence. Steps must also be taken to make the judicial disciplinary procedure transparent and better known and accessible to the public. Indeed, review the activities of the Commission on Judicial Conduct should be published regularly in the periodicals to which the public, not just lawyers, have access. Moreover, the public's participation in the proceedings of the CJC should be encouraged. The appointment of a guardian, a receiver, an auditor, or a lawyer is regularly abused by certain probate judges who use their discretion to enrich their friends and supporters. Changes should be made which accomplish the following. A committee similar to other fee dispute committees, for example, the Houston Bar Association Fee Dispute Committee, should be established to review appointee compensation in the event of complaints. And after a certain level of compensation has been approved by an appointing court, all further compensation should be approved by that committee. I would suggest that the maximum level of compensation that an appointing court should be allowed to approve should be $10,000. The fee review committee should be made up of judges, lawyers, and laypeople. Persons who wish to receive court appointments could be required to serve as part of their qualification requirements for such appointments, and efforts should be made to also have the laypeople include persons with an accounting background. Efforts should also be made to require the review to be made by persons outside the geographical area of the appointing court. Those reviews should be available to the interested parties who have a complaint concerning the appointee, either in terms of the appointee, the services, or the fees being charged. I know that in our case, we had circumstances where there were a number of appointees, one of which I mentioned to you claimed to be one of the best friends of Judge Wood. And when my lawyers or my children's lawyers inquired as to the reasonableness and necessity of their fees, we were denied the opportunity to receive answers to those questions.
Mr. Alford, I don't know whether Harris County has what we have in Bexar County, but the Bexar County Bar Association has, or San Antonio Bar Association has, a fee dispute committee. Do you know whether or not the Houston Bar
Have a fee dispute committee, but it doesn't deal with appointees of the court. It deals with lawyers who are retained by an individual in the ordinary course of representation.
Have you had, based on what you've indicated, it sounds like the sort of allegation that would appropriately be heard by the Commission on Judicial Conduct. Have you had any dealings with that commission?
I have not yet, and I may consider it. The problem that I have, though, is the Judicial Conduct Commission is a closed session, and I feel very strongly that when you're making allegations with the breadth and the depth of the kind of allegations that I've described here, that it should be open. And it's for that reason I haven't filed it. Mm-hmm. And the other reality is that right now, there's a real chance that we could be back before Judge Wood on the primary case, and we already are back before Judge Wood on the receiver case. That in itself is ludicrous. Mm-hmm. But we could find ourselves spending hundreds and hundreds of hours putting together a responsible case before the Council on Judicial Conduct. And if it's not open, then what purpose is it? We recently saw a case of a Judge Wendell, a probate judge, who had done quite a number of things wrong. And I was stunned that the Judicial Conduct Commission merely gave him a public reprimand. You know, to me, that's kind of a so what. Mm-hmm. A judge who is abusing the canons of judicial conduct should be removed from the bench. He doesn't have the confidence of the community that he serves, and he is pursuing his own agenda. And that's not what we elected them for.
Senator Gallegos has a question.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Alpert, you know, I've heard your testimony. It's pretty thorough. I'm not prepared to debate you on the specifics, but and it's my understanding that your case has been ongoing now for 7 years. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
It is now in the appellate courts.
Okay. If statements, as far as specifics of the testimony that you just gave us, if the judge made those remarks in public, I mean, I as a non-lawyer would immediately have sought a complaint with the Commission on Judicial Conduct. And I understand what you're talking about. It's behind closed doors. But if these statements were made in public, and you have witnesses to that effect, you know, that's pretty, to me, that's pretty strong. And especially the statement that you made that the judge said that law doesn't affect Harris County, that law affects San Antonio, not Harris County.
Well, sir, it's in the court transcript.
Well, I understand it. I'm talking about your attorney or whoever's representing your case, that if this thing has been going on 7 years, and like I said, I'm not prepared to debate you on the specifics, but the testimony is pretty thorough, you know, as a layman.